Trade routes were far more extensive than in the past. More people are traveling for business and for other purposes than ever before. And word of the plague spread. They knew about it in England for many, many months before it finally arrived. Churches in England actually ordered special prayers to avert the plague. People took all the precautions that they could under medieval conditions. They doubled up on almsgiving. They bought quack remedies. They put their affairs in order. But still, the plague came. And England was not in the best position to resist a major outbreak of disease. In an earlier lecture, we talked about the Great Famine during the reign of Edward II in the 1310s. And that disaster had weakened the immunity of an entire generation of English men and women. And the bad weather that caused that famine didn't get all that much better during the rest of the period before the Black Death. Europe seems to have entered a period when it was just colder and wetter than it had been before. And this is especially bad in Northern Europe, where the problem tends to be too much rain at the wrong time. So the English agricultural economy was already in something of a crisis when the plague hit. There had been a lot of crop failures, and so people were not as prepared as they should have been to resist an outbreak of disease. And other demographic factors were working against England at this point. The population had been expanding quite rapidly. When we talked about daily life in the 13th century, we saw that population expansion as a source of growth for the English economy, it was definitely a good thing. But at some point, around 1300 or so, England probably reached a tipping point. Pretty much all the available agricultural land was already under cultivation, and some of that was pretty marginal. The yields on those marginal lands were low. There simply wasn't any slack. Any crop failure was going to cause suffering. And the increase in population also meant that people were living much more closely together, and they were, of course, living under medieval standards of personal hygiene, and that clearly helped the spread of the disease. So let's follow the course of the disease across England. It probably arrives in Dorset in the southwest in June of 1348, maybe on a ship coming from Calais. And this is, of course, the town that Edward III had captured in the famous siege only the year before. So those trading contacts with the continent are turning into something of a drawback at this point. The disease then spread to other nearby towns, and by the fall, it's rife all over the West Country, including the major port of Bristol. And from there, it spread inexorably across the country from west to east, by two main routes, a northerly route from Oxfordshire and down into London, and a southerly route along the south coast through Hampshire into Surrey and thus to London again. The first cases were reported in the capital in the fall of 1348, but the plague didn't hit with full force there until the beginning of the following year. And things got so bad so fast in London that Edward III canceled an upcoming meeting of Parliament. Now, one historian has said about this that the king maybe was happy to spare himself the grumbling of Parliament. They had granted taxes the previous year. He didn't have much more to gain from letting them get together to complain about things. Such considerations were surely overwhelmed by the sheer scale of the deaths. The existing cemeteries in London were unable to accommodate all the bodies of the victims. A new graveyard at Smithfield was quickly opened up, and the Bishop of London hurriedly consecrated it. Nobody's sure how many people died in London, but one estimate says that out of a total population of 60 to 70,000, maybe 20 to 30,000 died. Try translating that sort of death toll into modern terms, and you get a sense of the scale of the disaster. All over England, town authorities were overwhelmed by the task of burying the dead. The supply of coffins quickly ran out, and in many places, towns were forced to resort to mass burials in plague pits. Modern scholars have excavated some of these plague pits, and when you see these bodies so densely packed together, it gives you a powerful sense of what it must have been like to experience this kind of suffering. Now, the plague hit the humble especially hard, as you might expect, but it did not spare the great either. At the time the plague hit London, A newly elected Archbishop of Canterbury was preparing to take office. It was the Chancellor, John Offord. He died before he could be enthroned. Pope Clement VI then appointed a famous scholar named Thomas Bradwardine to replace Offord. Bradwardine died while staying in the palace of the Bishop of Rochester in London. The city fathers of London were not spared either. London was the home of many guilds or associations of tradesmen, and they were led by wardens, and these were pretty exalted figures in London society. By the end of 1349, all 8 wardens of the Company of Cutters, cutters are people who cut out garments, all 8 of them were dead, and so were all 6 wardens of the Company of Hatters. Religious communities were sometimes hit especially hard, for example, at Westminster Abbey. The abbot at the time was a very difficult, very quarrelsome man named Simon de Burchiston. 20 years before the plague hit, he'd been prosecuted for attacking a royal stonemason, and he wasn't on the best of terms with his own community of monks. When the plague arrived, he tried to flee. In this period, they don't understand the germ theory of disease, but they do know that being close to plague victims makes it more likely that you're going to get sick yourself. So Simon de Burchiston tries to get out of town. As abbot of Westminster, he owns a fine manor in Hampstead. It's his country house, so to speak. But he brings the plague with him, and he dies there. And it doesn't go well for his monks either. 27 members of the Westminster community also died. Life in London was made worse by the fact that nobody wants to go to London once they know that the plague has hit there. By this point, London is very far from self-sufficient. The city depends on food supplies brought in from the countryside. But nobody wants to bring a cartload of produce into London in the midst of the plague. Now, of course, demand is dropping at the same time, so there's not a famine, but it's still a very hard time to be in London. Some Londoners are so desperate for bread that they fan out into the countryside looking for supplies. And of course, they just spread the plague with them. And the plague did spread even further. From London, it spread to East Anglia in March of 1349. It peaked there in May, June, and July. And we can tell this because there are records of the deaths recorded in the manor court rolls for the areas that were affected. And since manor courts met every 3 weeks or so, you can actually trace the arc of the mortality. The plague also spread north through the Midlands. It seems to have hit particularly hard in Lincolnshire for some reason. And one way to tell this is by looking at the records of when benefices became vacant. A benefice is a job in the church, such as being the priest of a particular parish. It was also referred to as a living because the clergyman made his living by holding the benefice. Well, in the Diocese of Lincoln, there were 2 archdeaconries. These are large units that dioceses were divided into for administrative purposes. In one of these archdeaconries, 45% of the beneficed clergy died. In the other archdeaconry, 57% of the beneficed clergy died. So in the whole diocese of Lincoln, about half of the clergy died of the plague. The mortality rate for clergy was high, of course, partly because a lot of them were actually doing their job. They're out ministering to the sick. They're performing last rites for the dying. That's what they're supposed to do. But this, of course, exposes them to the disease. We do have a few accounts of clerics fleeing, like poor Abbot Simon of Westminster, but many stood their ground. And the highest mortality rates could often be found among the religious orders whose special task it was to take care of the poor, such as the Franciscans and other friars. They tended to live right in the midst of the opportunity of the communities that they served, and they suffered disproportionately. And one result of this terrible mortality rate among clergymen is that the church is faced with a terrible staffing crisis after the plague subsides. It's a long process to train a priest. It's hard to replace half of them at one go. And in many instances, the church has to relax its standards and let people in who might have been rejected in former times. Canonical requirements, such as a minimum age, frequently got waived. And the quality of recruits was generally poor. And there were complaints about this particular cohort of priests, the plague generation, for a long time to come. Now, I've mentioned flight as one remedy for the plague. That's really the only one that worked, though people often fled too late, like Abbot Simon. But people tried all sorts of remedies. It was widely believed that plague came from bad air. So people tried breathing through special cloths that were supposed to filter out the plague. Other people wore special charms and amulets. Perhaps the strangest remedy that people resorted to was based on the idea that the plague was caused by bad air. It was believed that one bad odor could drive out another. A physician named John Call noted that people who took care of latrines or who worked in hospitals and other malodorous places were nearly all considered to be immune to the plague. I don't think this is really true, but he thought so. Worried citizens could sometimes be spotted crouched over a latrine for hours, trying to absorb the noxious smells so as to confer protection from the plague. And it worked about as well as you might have expected. Now, one thing the English didn't try in large numbers was a remedy that was briefly popular on the continent, namely self-flagellation. Groups of people, primarily in Germany, would travel around whipping each other as a penance for their sins. They would even wear special habits with holes cut in the back so that the scourges could have access to their bare flesh. Hundreds of these people tramped around Europe, and hundreds more participated in their ceremonies when they would pass through the major towns. But the English proved immune to the charms of the flagellants. A group of them arrived in London in September of 1349, and they performed their usual penitential rites. The response of the Londoners was polite but noncommittal. A few people expressed pity for their sufferings, but the flagellants made no new recruits among the English. This was not the way the English did things. So perhaps we can give the English some credit for being sensible in the face of disaster, but there was one ugly aspect of the European response to the Black Death that the English couldn't have participated in even if they wanted to, namely the persecution of Jews. In many parts of Europe, Jews were blamed for the plague. It was widely believed that Jews had poisoned the wells and that had caused the plague. And in fact, a Jewish man in Savoy was tortured into confessing his role in a supposed international conspiracy to spread the plague. Of course, it was all hysterical nonsense, but the English were spared involvement in it, not because they saw through the story, but because there were no Jews left in England to persecute. As you'll recall, they'd all been expelled more than 50 years before. Well, by the end of 1349, almost every corner of England has been visited by the plague. Then it subsided. It had run its course. But plague was going to return on a fairly regular basis in England for the next 300 years. The first of these major recurrences took place in 1361 to 62. And the cruel thing about this outbreak was it hit particularly hard among the children who had been born since the first outbreak. These were children who had, of course, no immunity to the plague, so they were especially vulnerable. So the new generation that had been born was also hit by the plague. The psychological impact of the plague was enormous. No one was ever sure when it might be coming back. If you look at things like funerary architecture in the years after the plague, it gets gloomier. Before the plague, you see tombs with statues of the deceased looking rather peaceful as they might have looked in life. After the plague, you see more of a grim representation of the effects of decay on the body. And this is supposed to remind the living of the fate that awaits them after death. And presumably this is going to concentrate their minds on heavenly things before it's too late. Now, these psychological effects of the Black Death are visible rather quickly, but some of the long-term social and economic effects took longer to make themselves felt, but there certainly were some very profound effects. Essentially, England had lost a third of its labor force. There's no way the English economy is not going to be affected by that. One obvious result you might expect from such a huge reduction in the labor force would be that wages would rise. There are now a lot fewer workers available, and that should improve their bargaining power. But that didn't happen right away for a couple of reasons. The first is that Parliament took steps to make sure it didn't happen. And in order to explain why, I need to repeat something about Parliament that I've touched on before. Parliament represents the men of substance in the realm, the men of property, the men with a stake in the established order. Men in Parliament are people who paid wages. They're not the people who earned wages. By and large, they're employers. So it's definitely in their economic interest to keep wage rates low. The members of Parliament could see the economic writing on the wall as well as we can, and they wanted to forestall it. Almost immediately after the plague hit, there were reports of laborers demanding higher rates of pay or refusing to undertake unappealing tasks. That had to be stopped. So in 1351, Parliament passed the Statute of Laborers. The statute set maximum wage rates, and it also ordered that all workers must work if called upon to do so. Now, these measures weren't completely effective, but they did hold down the rise in wages somewhat, and they proved to be a major grievance among the laboring classes in England, as we'll see in the next lecture. But there's another very intriguing reason why the wages of English laborers didn't go up right away, and this time it's not due to anybody trying to game the labor market. It comes out of conditions in the labor market itself. I talked at the beginning of the lecture about the fact that England had, in a sense, gotten overpopulated by the early 14th century. The economy simply wasn't developed enough to absorb all of the available labor. So after the plague hit, even after that huge drop in population, it actually took a long time for all the slack in the labor market to be taken up. And the pressure on wages that Parliament was complaining about wasn't nearly as great as you might have expected based on the sheer numbers. And this is a sign of how troubled the economy was just before the Black Death. But the numbers finally did begin to add up as the century wore on. And by the 1370s, there was steady upward pressure on laborers' wages. And tensions over wages are one of the triggers for the great Peasants' Revolt of 1381 that we're going to talk about in our next lecture. The effects of the Black Death on agriculture were also profound. A huge number of farms changed hands. Of course, many farms were inherited by close kin of those who died. But in a lot of instances, so many members of a family had died that it was hard to determine who really had a right to the holding. Again, we can trace these kinds of problems in the manor court rolls. And in many cases, there's simply nobody left to take over the farm. Many plots of land were just left untended. And we have a very vivid account of this from a report submitted in 1354 by the former vice-sheriff of Cumberland in the north. He said that the plague had been so devastating around the royal castle at Carlisle that most of the manor lands attached to the castle were still uncultivated. That's more than 4 years after the epidemic had passed. Indeed, the report said, for the first 18 months after the plague hit, the whole estate had lain waste for lack of laborers and diverse tenants. The pastures, the meadowlands, the mills, the fisheries, everything on the estate was just lying there. And this was not just a problem on royal estates. Landlords everywhere could get very desperate to find tenants. They didn't want to try to farm the land themselves directly if they could avoid it, because now they would be needing to hire workers. They'd be competing for labor in this new labor market that was not exactly favorable to employers. And this led landlords to compete for the best tenants. And that meant lowering rents and often commuting labor services. Now, what does that mean, commuting labor services? You'll remember when we talked about daily life in English villages that many tenants owed some sort of actual work to the lord of the manor, either help with the harvest or some other agricultural tasks like carting produce to market or spreading manure. And these labor services are referred to as servile dues because they marked tenants off as belonging to the class of serfs, If you had to work for the boss on certain days and at certain tasks, that made you a serf. And if your status was called into question in the manor court, for example, your fate would often be decided based on whether your neighbors had always seen you spreading manure for the Lord. That would be a case closed, you're a serf. Now, landlords were having to compete for tenants, and they were having to offer attractive terms. So along with lowering rents, they often simply abolished these servile dues. They commuted them the way you would commute a sentence today. And the effect of this was profound. Slowly but surely, it became impossible for landlords anywhere to insist on these servile dues. They became hopelessly old-fashioned. They simply withered away. And by the 15th century, they were quickly disappearing. And the result is that English peasants looked freer and freer. If you're not spreading manure anymore, you're not a serf. You're a free man or woman. And this is a good thing for the peasants, of course. And there's another happy effect of the Black Death, at least on the economic front. The loss of population in England means that demand for all sorts of goods and services was depressed, which means prices fell. That's a good thing for anybody trying to survive on wages in the cash economy. Prices are falling, wages are going up. So what are we to make of the Black Death overall? Obviously, the human toll is staggering. Families are devastated. Institutions of all sorts are disrupted. The church may have gone through a quality control crisis for at least a generation. But on the social and economic fronts, the long-term consequences of the Black Death actually benefited the people at the bottom of the ladder, the people who survived. They had far more bargaining power than they had ever had before, and they used it. The 15th century has been called the golden age of the English yeoman, that is, the small independent farmer. And one big reason for that was that the yeoman had less competition than before. But before we get to the golden age of the 15th century, we need to look at one last big conflict between the men of substance and the people at the bottom. We'll look at how the landlords tried to stave off the inevitable results of the famine, and how common folk responded. Next time, the English Peasants' Revolt.
Lecture 28, The Peasants' Revolt of 1381.
Welcome back. In our last lecture, we talked about the Black Death, and I suggested that there were some long-term consequences that followed from the great mortality that resulted from the plague. You lose a third of the population, that's a third fewer people in the labor supply, that's a third fewer people who might want to become tenants for agricultural land. That's going to do something to the economy. But I also hinted that the propertied classes in England are not going to bow to these market forces without a fight. They've actually gotten Parliament to pass restrictions on wages so that they're not going to drift up too high. Now, this is a sign of what we might call, in very loose terms, class conflict. And we're going to see it play out today in the largest, most threatening revolt of the entire Middle Ages in England. Now, so far, we've looked at a lot of rebellions in this course, but they've been baronial rebellions. At first, these rebellions were simply about getting a better deal out of the king. They're completely self-interested. The revolts in the 11th and 12th century are like that. Then, starting at the time of Magna Carta, you start to see barons claiming that they are rebelling for the good of the realm. Now, there's still plenty of self-interest involved. A lot of the grievances that the barons have are about privileges that benefit them personally. But they're now acting together, at least partly, in the interests of the realm as a whole. Or at least in the interests of one segment of the population of the realm, the people with property. Now, remember the baronial revolt of Henry III's reign in the 13th century? Remember the Song of Lewis, that wonderful political song that I talked about, that called for a fair distribution of escheats and wardships? Now, that's not really directed at the masses. But in 1381, you do get a rebellion that's aimed at the grievances of the lower orders in society. And it shakes the elite society of England to the core. But I do have to start by qualifying even that statement, that the rebellion is one of the lower orders. It's actually one of the top tier of the lower orders. We call the revolt the peasants' revolt, but that's not strictly accurate, not at least in terms of who actually took part. Most of the people who ended up participating in the revolt were a cut above ordinary peasants. They were small-scale tradespeople. Some of them were even members of the lower ranks of the clergy. This isn't a howling mob of yokels. And their demands are actually fairly sophisticated, as we'll see. Certainly, they're asking for things that are going to benefit the broad class of people at the bottom of society. But it's actually a fairly well-thought-out economic program. It's not just a call to kill all the landlords. There was an actual peasants' revolt in France in the 1350s that was like that, where the rebels did just go out and kill landlords. But not in England. Some people are killed in this revolt in 1381, but far fewer than you might expect when you have thousands of angry people on the march. It's a fairly orderly revolt. And I think that comes from the fact that the people rebelling are actually fairly respectable types. The other thing you see in the revolt is that there's a mixture of economic grievances and religious grievances, and that certainly comes from the fact that you have members of the lower clergy involved. In a sense, there are two hierarchies being attacked, the church and the state, and the rebels have their grievances against both of them. So it's an attack on entrenched powers of all kinds. But again, in the case of the church, it's not a blind attack on the institution as a whole. They don't want to abolish it. They merely want to reform it, rather substantially. So I would argue that the rebels are actually rather moderate in their demands. And this is a characteristic of English revolts throughout history from this point on. Really, they're actually pretty conservative. But let me stress, that's how it looks to us as modern people. We've seen real radical revolts. We've seen the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution. And the revolt in 1381 doesn't look like that. But to the powers that be in 1381, it must have seemed like the end of the world. So let's set the stage for the revolt. The first thing I want to talk about is who is the king who's going to confront the rebels? It's young Richard II, the son of Edward the Black Prince and the grandson of Edward III. Now, Richard had come to the throne in 1377 because his father, the Black Prince, had actually died the year before. He died before King Edward III died. And Richard is then 10 years old when he comes to the throne. And it's interesting to note here that there wasn't really any controversy about the succession. This is different from earlier in English history, say, at the time of King John. Nobody is saying now, in 1377, you just can't have a child as king the way they had earlier. Now, Richard had plenty of very plausible grown-up uncles who could have succeeded. But by this point, the principle of dynastic legitimacy is very well established. And also, I think the state has developed sufficiently to this point. It can be ruled more easily by the various organs of government, even if the king isn't old enough to rule personally himself. And another very important thing, the uncles are loyal to their nephew. This is a close-knit family, especially John of Gaunt. He's really at the heart of royal government in this period. Still, Richard is the king, and he's arguably going to have his finest hour when he faces down the rebels personally at the age of 14. The reign went downhill after that, as we'll see in a future lecture. All right, now we've got little Richard on the throne, but things in England are difficult. The last years of Edward III's reign had not been good for England. King Edward III had slipped into senility towards the end. And the war in France was not going well. It had started up again in 1369, and things were definitely not going the way of the English. They were losing territory very rapidly. Royal finances, as a result, were in a terrible condition. And so, between 1377 and 1381, Parliament passed a series of taxes. And these taxes took a new form. Before this, taxes were mostly collected from people of some means. And the most common form of tax was a kind of excise tax on the value of your movable goods. You'd be taxed, for example, a 15th part of the value of your goods. Now, most people at the bottom of the social ladder have almost no goods to speak of, so this doesn't really affect them. But now, Parliament is trying to spread the net more widely. So they pass a series of poll taxes. And this term comes from an English word that meant head. So a poll tax is a tax per head or per person. And you have to pay it regardless of how much property you own. Now, it was graduated based on your economic status, so the richest people paid more. But for many poor people, the rate of 4 pence per head was a hardship, and the rate went up. The poll tax that touched off the revolt had been increased to a shilling a head. Now, that's 3 times the initial rate of 4 pence per person. And the rebels were very angry about the poll tax because this is the same Parliament that had tried to be keeping down their wages, and now they're raising taxes on them. So the poll tax was added to grievances about wage regulations. And this is a very explosive political situation. Now, you also need to add to this economic controversy the fact that England is seeing its first ever serious religious turmoil. And the two are not unrelated. When people are already upset about the economy, they tend to resent the wealth and power of the church. And this isn't new. There had always been grumbling about this. In the 1370s, you see a movement appear that's trying in a concerted way to do something about it. So let me explain. Where does hostility to the institutional church come from? We've talked before about various conflicts between church and state in England. We looked at the showdown between King John and Pope Innocent III. In the 14th century, English kings and the English public got increasingly fed up with papal interference in the English church. Now, Innocent III had been a powerful pope, but his successors were even more powerful. They were able to name their own candidates to bishoprics in England more and more without the English kings being able to do anything about it. And they even started naming people to less important positions in the English church, like archdeacons. This was a process known as papal provisions. And this is the Pope essentially using his right of patronage to put his own men into the good jobs in the English church. And quite often these people are foreigners, often Italians. And often these men have no intention of moving to England and actually doing the job that they're named to. They just want the paycheck. So it's not a very good thing for the spiritual situation in England at all. And perhaps just as important, it means that all of that patronage isn't available to go to English churchmen. So papal provisions are not popular in England. And in 1351, Parliament passes the Statute of Provisors, which tries to limit the practice of papal provisions. Now, in practice, they continue. Usually the kings prefer to do a deal with the Pope, something that is to their mutual advantage, and they only crack down on provisions when there isn't an ability to come up with a satisfactory bargain. But it's a sign of how the English are beginning to resent foreign interference in their church. And the whole practice does not shed a good light on the clergy, especially the higher clergy, the ones who might be provided by the Pope. There's not a lot of respect for these people. And in addition, 2 years after that Statute of Provisors, Parliament passes the Statute of Praemunire. And this is a way of trying to limit the number of cases relating to church property that are referred to Rome. Basically, there's a mood that these things have to be settled in England. Finally, English kings are also objecting very strongly to attempts by the popes to tax the English clergy. This is something the English kings want to have full control of themselves. So there's definitely hostility to the hierarchy at work at the top. Now, one big reason that people aren't happy about papal interference in the English church is that the church in the 14th century has some big credibility problems. This is the period when the popes have to live in exile from Rome. They've been driven out of the city of Rome by civil disorders there. And in 1309, they take up residence in the city of Avignon, which is now part of France. At the time, it was sort of semi-autonomous, but definitely under French influence. Now, this period is usually called the Avignon Papacy, but it also has a less flattering nickname. It's called the Babylonian Captivity of the Church. And of course, as I said, while the popes are in Avignon, they're very much under the influence of the French kings. Now, this is the time when the Hundred Years' War is going on, so that's not going to make the English respect the popes very much at all. And to make matters worse, in 1378, there was a disputed papal election. And for more than three decades, there were two popes. At one point, there were even three popes. This is the period referred to as the Great Schism. Now, one of the popes had managed to go back to Rome, and the other one is in Avignon. And the countries of Europe pick sides. So the French, of course, go with the Avignon pope, so naturally the English go with the Roman pope. It's a very sorry spectacle. Now, just at the moment when the institutional church is involved in all of these very unedifying proceedings, England produces its first homegrown heresy. And it comes from an Oxford professor named John Wycliffe. And of course, he's a cleric, because to teach at a university, you had to be a cleric in this period. And Wycliffe produces a coherent, theologically based critique of the institutional church. Wycliffe attacked some of the core tenets of the Catholic Church, and quite a bit of what he said was actually going to end up as part of the Protestant program at the time of the Reformation. Now, here's what Wycliffe argued, and I think you'll see why the institutional church was so unhappy about him. First, he believed it was possible for individual believers to find a mystical union with God apart from the sacraments that were administered by the church. Now, right away, if that's true, you're taking away a lot of the reason for being of the whole infrastructure of the church. And he also specifically denied the doctrine of transubstantiation. This was the belief that the bread and wine at communion is actually turned into the body and blood of Jesus Christ, not symbolically, but in some mystical, physical, actual sense. And the doctrine of transubstantiation gave a very special status to the clergy because only they could bring about transubstantiation. But if you say it doesn't work that way, there isn't any mystical transformation, then you have a lot less need for the clergy with their special status. Furthermore, Wycliffe attacked the notion that the institutional church should have a monopoly on interpreting the scriptures for the faithful. Now, until now, the church had been very concerned about making sure that only the clergy had the right to preach the gospel, only the people they had vetted. They were very nervous about unauthorized preaching. So the Bible was available only in Latin, only to people with special training. And Wycliffe argued that the Bible should be available in the vernacular so that all believers could read it for themselves and interpret it for themselves. And he made the first ever full translation of the Bible into English. Now, these are pretty radical attacks on the special status of the clergy, but Wycliffe took the next logical step. He said, if you don't really need the clergy for very much, then the clergy doesn't need all that property they have. He thought it should all be confiscated. And this was a very radical notion. The church was a huge landowner in medieval England. Many, many people would have rented their lands from various churches. The church would be their landlord. And the idea of taking the church completely out of the business of owning land, that was revolutionary. So Wycliffe is pretty radical, and he gets denounced, predictably, by the authorities, both ecclesiastical and civil. His English Bible was outlawed. But interestingly, he escaped serious punishment himself. The worst that happened to him was that he had to leave Oxford. He had to live a very simple life as parish priest in Lutterworth in Leicestershire. And he was defiant to the end. But one reason he seems to have attracted, to not have been condemned, is that he attracted the patronage of a very powerful man, John of Gaunt, the uncle of the king. But the authorities did go after Wycliffe's followers. Quite a few of his old Oxford colleagues were initially drawn to his ideas. And then the ideas spread to the lower orders of society, as well through local networks of traveling preachers. And the wool towns of eastern England proved to be especially strong centers of this heresy. There were lots of itinerant craftsmen and tradesmen involved in the various aspects of the wool trade. And they would take Wycliffe's ideas around with them from village to village and town to town. The people who followed Wycliffe's ideas became known as Lollards. And no one is really sure why. The term has several possible origins, but the most likely seems to be that it comes from a Middle Dutch word that means to mumble. And this was probably a reference to the way they prayed, or possibly to the way that they passed along their ideas to their fellow Lollards. But certainly the term was meant to be insulting, and it carried with it the sense that these people were uneducated, that they were playing around with matters that were above their ability to understand. Now, the civil authorities in England took the Lollard threat very seriously. England had always prided itself on not having a heresy problem, not like in France. They did have a lot of heresy there. So there was a major effort to crack down on the Lollards. And Parliament passed laws against Lollardy, and they got more and more severe, until in 1401, they passed a law known as De Heretico Comburendo, which means on the burning of heretics. And this was the first time in English history that a law was passed to authorize the execution of heretics. There hadn't been much need for this before. But now the Lollards were forcing the state to react. So if we take all of these religious factors together, the hostile relations with the papacy, the Babylonian captivity, the Great Schism, the Lollards, it's a fairly tense religious atmosphere. From the king on down to the very lowest rung of the social ladder, there are grievances out there against the institutional church. But the English government wants to make sure that attacks against the church don't get out of hand. The king and parliament want to tinker with relations between church and state, but they don't want to overturn the established order completely. Only the Lollards want to do that. But Lollardy is very much in the air in the spring of 1381. And that's when you get an explosive mixture of religious resentment and economic resentment, and it leads to the Peasants' Revolt. It starts in the southeastern counties of Kent and Essex due to frustration with the latest poll tax. Commissioners had been sent out from London to collect the poll tax, and in late May and early June, bands of rebels attacked the commissioners, and then they started attacking other targets. And here's where you see all of the various resentments of the lower orders coming to the fore. They attacked religious houses, not so much in their capacity as clergy, but because they were landlords. And this is that resentment about church property that Wycliffe was tapping into. The rebels also attacked royal castles. They attacked noblemen. They killed or severely wounded several royal officials. And here's one of the most interesting aspects of the revolt. They destroyed legal records wherever they could find them. There was great hostility to the law among the rebels. They definitely had a sense that the law was there to protect property, to keep the lower orders in their place, in debt, in servitude. And if you destroyed the records of all that, maybe everybody would just be free. The rebels ended up coalescing in bands around particular leaders. The leader of the rebels in Kent was a man named Wat Tyler. Wat's short for Walter. He was a local tradesman. His name, Tyler, probably means he was a roof tiler by profession. Another prominent figure in the revolt was a priest named John Ball. He was one of those clerics from the very bottom of the clerical hierarchy. And he'd been strongly influenced by Wycliffe. In fact, he'd been in and out of ecclesiastical prisons several times, and he'd been forbidden to preach. He was actually in the Archbishop's prison in Maidstone, in Kent, when the revolt broke out. And there are reports, we don't know how reliable they are, but there are reports that John Ball had been involved in planning an uprising before the revolt broke out. And supposedly, the rebels even had a watchword set up. It was the phrase, John the Miller grinds small, small, small. And the response is supposed to be, the King's Son of Heaven shall pay for all. Whether there was anything premeditated or not, one of the first things the rebels did was to break John Ball out of jail. So he's probably a pretty important person among the discontented element in Kent. And once he's with the rebels, he preaches sermons to them that contain all of the radical notions that Wycliffe had been promoting. And famously, he uses a rhyme that was current at the time. Nobody knows who first made it up, but it was meant as a critique of the idea of social hierarchy. And this is how it goes. When Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the gentleman? In other words, at the beginning of mankind, you don't have lords and serfs. There's no religious justification for some men being of higher status than others. That's a notion that would certainly make the powers that be sit up and take notice. Well, the revolt apparently broke out almost simultaneously in various parts of the southeast, particularly in Kent and Essex. And by the second week of June, large groups of rebels begin to converge on London. And we're talking about literally thousands of people on the roads heading towards London. And there they join forces with disaffected members of the lower orders in the city of London. And the rebels were quite targeted in their attacks. And that tells us, I think, they have quite a bit of knowledge of who is who. They burned the Savoy Palace. That was the London residence of John of Gaunt. Clearly, the rebels saw John of Gaunt as the public face of the king's government. Now, fortunately for John of Gaunt, he was away on the Scottish marches at the time, or he would very likely have ended up dead. The rebels also attacked the Tower of London, where they managed to seize the Chancellor, Simon Sudbury, who was also Archbishop of Canterbury. They seized the treasurer, Sir Robert Hales. Sudbury was particularly associated with the poll tax, and so was Hales. And since Hales was also the prior of the Order of Hospitallers, buildings owned by that order also were attacked. And both Sudbury and Hales were beheaded. And in addition, the rebels attacked all the buildings they could find where legal records were kept and systematically destroyed them. The rebels also attacked one other class of victims, and this takes a bit more explaining. They went after Flemish merchants. There was a large contingent of merchants from Flanders living in London due to the wool trade, and this was part of an established pattern of English hostility to foreigners. And it may very well have been instigated by the local London element, the people who knew who the Flemings were. Certainly, there is an opportunity being taken to settle all sorts of scores in the general atmosphere of revolt. But as we've seen, this is not merely a mob. They know what they want. And apparently, they formulated very specific demands, and these demands were conveyed to King Richard, who was in the city at the time. So here's what they want. They want the end of serfdom. They want there to be no lord but the king. So this is an attack on social hierarchy. They want rents limited to 4 pence an acre. So this means the government should be keeping rents down just the way Parliament had been keeping wages down. So the shoe's on the other foot now. They also want the property of the church to be confiscated and distributed among the people. Oh, and one more thing. They want the heads of the chancellor, the treasurer, and John of Gaunt. Now, of course, by the time the king gets the demands, the chancellor and the treasurer have been taken care of. Now, this is quite a list of demands, and Wat Tyler wants to discuss them in person with the king. So he demands an appointment with King Richard for June 15th at Smithfield, right outside the city. And the amazing thing is, the king went. I think he and his advisors felt that it would be the better part of valor to seem to go along with the rebels. The king did not have a lot of good options. There aren't a lot of troops in the city, and there's no police force. And there are literally thousands of these rebels. They've already executed 2 top royal officials. So the king went to meet the rebels. And I have to say that whatever you think of Richard later in his reign, this was a pretty brave thing for a 14-year-old boy to do. So now you have the king and the rebels, thousands of them, gathered in an open field outside of London. And the Lord Mayor of London is also there, a guy named William Walworth. What's going to happen? It must have been very tense. We have various accounts of the meeting. They conflict in some details, but essentially this is what happened. Something triggered off a reaction by the Lord Mayor. Either Wat Tyler made some sort of disrespectful gesture to the king, one account says he refused to take off his cap to the king, or Tyler made some sort of sudden threatening gesture. Something happened to make the Lord Mayor react, and Walworth stabbed Wat Tyler with a dagger. Now, obviously, this could have been the start of a terrible riot, but the king called out to the rebels that he would gladly listen to all their demands if they would only follow him into the fields further outside the city. And amazingly, they did. And I think this is a sign of the essential conservatism of the rebels. They're not attacking the institution of monarchy. They want to follow the king. They want him to have the answers. But of course, it's a trap. Richard has bought enough time for the few troops he does have to come up and arrest the remaining ringleaders of the revolt. And the rank-and-file members of the mob quickly disperse and return to their homes. And the concessions made under pressure to the rebels are repudiated. The leaders are executed, including John Ball. But really, you don't see the sort of savage, wholesale reprisals that you might have expected. You're talking about dozens executed, not hundreds or thousands. The English government seems really to have just breathed a sigh of relief that they got through the whole thing, and they just want to go back to normal as quickly as possible. Many of the rebels just fade back into the background. So what should we conclude about the revolt? I think there are several points worth stressing, and I'm just going to make four. First, I've already said, this is a conservative revolt. The rebels don't want to kill the king. They just want him on their side. Second, it's a revolt not of the desperate, but of the ambitious. These are not the social dregs. These are the people who are hoping to benefit from the rising tide that followed the demographic catastrophe of the Black Death. Some historians have called the revolt a crisis of rising expectations. The rebels don't want to wait for landlords to be forced to raise their wages and lower their rents. They want this now. The third point I want to make is that the government did, to a certain degree, get the point. Most of the rebels' demands went unmet, of course. The church was not stripped of its property, lordship was not abolished, but, and this is important, the poll tax was scrapped. That had been the trigger that started off the whole thing, and the government concluded it wasn't worth it. So you do see a fairly hard-headed political calculation being made. The government is, in a real sense, responsive to public pressure. Now, the final point I want to make about the revolt may seem an odd one. I've talked about thousands of rebels on the move, palaces being burned down, Flemish merchants hunted down and killed. All of that is true. But yet, both the rebels and the government acted, I think, with considerable restraint. The violence of the rebels was not indiscriminate, and neither was the official response. England was not a savage country. It was not a cruel country. Had its share of class conflict, obviously. But there was quite a bit of social cohesion nonetheless, enough to restrain the excesses that you might have expected when you have a giant mob of aggrieved people on the move. There's thus a sense in which the peasants' revolt of 1381 is really quite English, conservative and rather restrained. Now, of course, that's our perspective. I have no doubt it was a pretty terrifying experience to live through. Well, in our next lecture, we're going to look at this question of Englishness in a particular way. We're going to look at the rise of the English language. It had been cast in the shadow of by the Norman conquest, but now we're going to see it come into its own as the vehicle for one of the world's great literatures.
Lecture 29, Chaucer and the Rise of English.
Welcome back. In our last lecture, we looked at the English Peasants' Revolt. We saw that the broad masses of English people were making their voices heard, really for the first time, on the English political stage. They didn't get everything they wanted, but they did get rid of the poll tax they hated. Today we're going to be talking about the language in which they made their voices heard, the English language. This period, the 14th century, is when the English language really comes into its own as a written language, a literary language, even a theological language, a language that can finally compete with Latin and French on a far more equal footing than ever before. Let's remind ourselves of where things have stood with regard to language up until now. Of course, Latin is at the top of the hierarchy of languages. It's the language of the church, of course, but it's also the language of many kinds of official records. And if you want to claim to be educated in this period, you have to know Latin. The language of the universities of Oxford and Cambridge is Latin. And Latin there is a spoken language as well as a written language. All oral exams at the universities were conducted in Latin. And sermons that were preached mostly for a clerical audience were preached in Latin. But that kind of command of Latin is certainly restricted to the clerical elite. The prestige language of the lay elite is French, and this was true right through the 13th century and beyond. Literature composed in England about English topics is written in French. Now, the autobiographical poem about William Marshall that I talked about a couple of lectures ago, that was in French. So were lots of other stories about famous English knights. And French was also the language of the common law courts, to the extent that we have a special term for the jargon that developed in these courts. It's called law French. English, on the other hand, had basically died out as a written language after the Norman conquest. There are a few exceptions to this. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle lingered on in a single version down to the mid-12th century. And there's also an important English poem by a priest called Lachaman. It's essentially an expanded translation of Wace's Brut, which was itself a translation of Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain. Now, the sections that Lachaman added were mostly about King Arthur. So this is, in the 12th century, the very first Arthurian literature in the English language. That's pretty much it. There are a few ballads, a few religious works, but not a lot is being written in English. However, political reality is on the side of English in the long run. As long as the Angevin Empire was intact, there was more or less constant contact between England and France, and that really helped to foster the idea that the elite of England is part of one large French-speaking cultural zone. But the link is broken during John's reign. Now, although the habit of using French lingers for a long time, it got to be more and more of an affectation. It was less and less of a thing that people would acquire naturally. French starts to be something that is hard to learn. And we have French sources from the period that make a commentary about the inferior French that Englishmen spoke. And by the time we get to Chaucer in the late 14th century, Chaucer himself is making fun of this English-acquired French. He refers to the prioress in the Canterbury Tales and her French. He says that she spoke the French of Stratford-atte-Bow, because the French of Paris was by her unknown, so her French is awful. Now, Chaucer is obviously mocking the social pretensions of the prioress, but I don't think he would have done so 100 years before. In that time, the tide is starting to turn against French. Now, one of the big reasons for this is one we've already discussed when we talked about the Hundred Years' War. Now, it's ironic that you have a war that's supposedly being fought so that the English king can establish his claim to the French throne. But along with this, you get a lot of anti-French sentiment, and this has an effect on people wanting to learn French. But this, I think, is just the last straw. The development has been going on for centuries, the decline of French. French had never been the language of the majority. The Normans had never had the ability or